Okay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce. I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker, Tom W. from Palm Desert.
Oh my God! My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Pam for asking me to come and speak tonight. Appreciate that. Thank you. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I have today, all the good stuff, is absolutely a direct result of this program, the 12 steps, and sponsorship, fellowship, and all. And I appreciate that. I want to congratulate the birthday people. Welcome the newcomers. And tell you, we're glad you're here. You're probably not real glad about it right now, but as my friend Dean says, welcome to Plan B. And just hope that you stick around and grasp this program and get into it, get a sponsor, get to a lot of meetings, and do what you can to stick around here. And do what they told me when I first came in, same thing. And they said, give us 90 days. And at the end of that 90 days, you don't feel like this is your thing, and we'll gladly refund your misery. And that's what they'll do. We'll gladly, and it was nothing but misery out there. I was not a rock at the start of when I came in here. The first 2 years, I made it as tough on myself as I could. As my sponsor used to tell me, I was nickel and diming it. And I would, kind of the way I did my whole life, you know, I would get by and do the best I could until it's like a bank account. You get a little bit in the bank, and then you just slough off and just rest on your laurels. And that's the way I did this program. And I have a tape at home of my first sponsor. And I was taking a 5-year cake. And he spoke at a meeting where I was a secretary. And he got up there and he said, I've never been able to pick in this program who's going to make it and who is not going to make it. He said, I would have bet everything I had that Tom was not going to make it. And I almost didn't. I mean, I had some close calls. I was ready to drink 3 different times. I had what I call divine interventions. I'll go into one of those later on. So I just couldn't grasp this. You know, it's just that I didn't take it serious. I just wasn't, I thought, yeah. I wasn't really that bad. I didn't really think I was an alcoholic. I knew I drank too much. And I had my first wife used to tell me I was an alcoholic. And I'd say, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a drunk. And she'd say, well, what the hell's the difference? And I said, drunk doesn't have to go to those damn meetings. You know? And I never thought one day I would be going to those damn meetings. As I said, I didn't. You know, I wasn't the rock at the stardom here. I took my time about doing things. I just had a lot of problems. I just didn't understand the program. I just didn't really. I mean, I thought you kind of got this by osmosis or something. You know, you didn't realize there was a little bit of work that you had to do for it, and until I learned to do that, this thing, you know, it became a lot easier. I had my first drink when I was 12 years old. Now, I hear a lot of people say when they have their first drink that they took that first drink and it went down and went, and it was just what they were looking for. When I had my first drink, it was the absolute opposite. I was 12 years old. I had some older cousins that I hung around with that stole some beer someplace, and they hid it down in this wash. And it was on a Sunday afternoon, and it was in August. And the beer sat out all day. And I was hanging around with the big guys, so they were drinking the beer, and then they hand me one. And I had never had, to my knowledge at that point, never had anything to drink, any kind of alcohol before that. And I drank 2 bottles of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Remember that beer? I got hammered. I mean, hammered. And they were trying to take me, they took me to the show. And got me down and stuck me in a corner and said, be quiet, just go to sleep. And I started watching the movie. I looked up at the movie, and it was a Western movie. And I saw this stagecoach going along. and the wheel was going backwards. You know, I couldn't figure out the wheel was turning backwards, and I started going backwards. And then I felt it coming up, and up, jumped up, and yeah, out it came. I got the people in front of me, some people on the side of me. They grabbed me and ran me down the aisle and took me out the back door, and they stuck me under a bush someplace in this building and, you know, sleep it off, which I did for about 3 hours while they were at the show. When I woke up, I was so sick, and I thought, God, I will never, never do this again, never. You know, I mean, I even had a hangover the next day, which I didn't even know was a hangover. And I said, that's it. You know, I will not ever. Now I understand. And I come from a family that, you know, my mother didn't drink. My father didn't drink. I have a brother that drank, but, you know, he's not an alcoholic. And I have two sisters that don't drink. And I was kind of the black sheep of the family. I was the one, my mother always said, that boy's going to be the death of me. You know, just, it was kind of adventurous. You know, I was a thrill seeker. I wanted to be a stuntman. I used to do a lot of things. I used to get hurt a lot. And I used to hear from her, you know, what the hell ever possessed you to do that? You know, it just, I don't know. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And so I went, like, it was probably three more years. And I was about 15, and my buddy Howard and I, we were young entrepreneurs, and we were mowing lawns, and we had a little business going after school. And we mowed this lawn for this lady who was a regular customer, and she had to leave that day. And she said, I'm going to leave, and I'm going to pay you guys now, and just put the lawnmower and everything back in the garage. It was fine. We finished our job, and we were putting the lawnmower and the edger back. And those were push lawnmowers, too, in those days. And we put them back in the garage, and this lady had a liquor barn in there. I mean, there was about 15 or 20 cardboard boxes full of booze. Well, Howard's eyes lit up. You know, he said, oh, my God, look at this, you know. We could take a couple of bottles, and she would never miss it. There's so much here. And I said, you know, I'm not interested. So we ended up taking about three or four bottles, a couple of bottles of wine, a couple of bottles of beer. And we went down on this channel behind General Motors there in the San Fernando Valley, and a couple other guys came with us. And we drank. I drank some wine. And this time it was different. All of a sudden, I got about halfway. I wasn't drunk, but I got about halfway there. And as the big book tells us in here, this phenomena of craving started to take over. And I wanted more. And we had finished all the booze off. I said, we need to go back and get some more. So we hurried up, went back, and we stopped by our friend Weldon's house and picked up his little brother's wagon and pulled that back over there. And got two full boxes of something. I don't know what it was. We just started throwing. We kind of mixed things up and figured she won't miss this. We take something out of each box. And we took it up in this big lot with all these trees. We buried it for future. And it was in the afternoon. It was daylight. And the neighbor saw us doing it and went and told Weldon's dad. And Weldon came home. And his dad finally beat a confession out of him. And we had to take the booze back. I had to go dig it up and bring it back. And the lady kind of looked at us, you know, and we kind of had our heads down. And that was the first job I got fired from for drinking. Yeah, and that was it. My lawnmower day was over there. So after that, booze became a little easier. I didn't, you know, I had my days. It's always funny. I think one of those guys used to go out on Friday nights. We had different ways we'd go out or that we'd drink. If we were going out looking for girls up at Bob's Big Boy, which was the big hangout, we just got a couple quarts of beer. If we weren't looking for girls and just wanted to get drunk, we got a six-pack of Country Club. I don't know if you remember the little stout cans. And you drink a six-pack of those, and they would knock you right on your keister. And, you know, we did that, and I just it's just kind of the way I drank for up. And I'd go on these binges, and then I'd stop, and then I'd, you know, I mean, I just never got in a lot of trouble with it. I went in the service. I didn't get in a lot of trouble. They were drinking, and I got out. Meanwhile, my two best friends, Russ and Jack, had gotten married, and not to each other, but and I thought, well, guess that's maybe what I should do, you know. So I go into Bob's Big Boy, and a waitress waits on me, and 2 months later we got married. Or I should say she got married. I didn't get married. I was every father's nightmare for a son-in-law, I'll tell you. I I just, the more, when I got married, my drinking just increased. I mean, it just became more and more important to me. And I had a problem getting home afterwards. You know, I go into those bars, and I was a bar drinker, and I love those bars. And I heard a guy speak one night, talked about the bars. He said, I like those kind of bars. And he walked through the front door, he could smell the men's room. And that's just kind of, you know, that's just kind of, you know, the kind of dies. I want to hear pool balls clicking, smoke in there, the jukebox is playing some sad song that somebody left somebody or something. And just a lot of people in there, and just the camaraderie. I mean, you meet so many best friends you meet in there. I mean, it's God Almighty. And you can solve a lot of the world's problems. I used to think some of the politicians should go sit in bars and take care of some of this stuff. And but I would hang in his bar, and I just couldn't get home, you know. And I honestly meant when I went in to have just a couple of beers and I was going to go home, or a couple of drinks. But it seemed like the minute that bartender set it down in front of me, a little voice came out of it and said, I don't care what you had planned tonight, you're mine now. And that's the way it was. And I would be there until it closed up. And I would get home at night at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and pull in the driveway. And I'd honk my horn to let my wife and the neighbors know I got home safe. And I'd sleep in the car. You know, I couldn't go in the house because it was always too hot in there, and I'd have to sleep in the front seat of the car. I know one afternoon or night, late night, my daughter and her girlfriend came home. She was staying with her, and they come home late. She walked by the car, and her girlfriend let out a yell. She said, oh, my God, Carrie. And she said, what? She said, your father, he's laying over in the front seat of the car. She said, don't worry, he's just drunk, you know. And they just knew. And I would promise not. And one of the toughest things I had to do, when I made one of my amends to my oldest son, Thursday night where I worked was always pay night. And you go to the bar afterwards, our bartender would cash the checks, and, you know, you'd spend the evening there. My oldest son was a track runner. He ran cross country, and he ran different kinds of, you know, events, and his track meets were always on Thursday nights. And every morning, on Thursday morning, I promised him I would be at that track meet. No, I was going to be there, I promised him. 3 years of high school, I never made one track meet. Never made one. Because the minute I got in that bar, like I said, it got a hold of me. I had my two friends, I said, spoke about Jack and Russ, who got married. We'd been friends since we were like 12 years old. And we grew up together, and we spent a lot of time together. And they were at the house one day, and we hadn't been married too long. And come around a Saturday, and he brought a couple of cases of beer. And my wife got a little upset and went to the bedroom and shut the door. And we sat there and drank and listened to music, just had a great time. And I walked in the kitchen. I had to go in the kitchen and light a cigarette off the stove. And I guess the gas had been on. And I don't know how long it had been on, but as I bent over to light the cigarette, just all I remember seeing was just big poof, and this flame hit me in the side and burned all the side of my hair off, burnt the side of my face, knocked me into the front room. And Jack and Russ sat there and clapped their hands and thought it was cool. Do it again. And my wife couldn't drive, and those guys are too drunk to take me, and I was too drunk to drive. And I had a next-door neighbor who was about 25 years old, and she was gorgeous, and had a leopard skin bikini bathing suit on, and took me to the hospital. And I had to get all my hair shaved off because it was just frizzy along. You just burn it all off the side, and I had like second degree burns on the side of my face. And until I quit smoking, I never lit a cigarette off the stove again, ever. And naturally, my wife was not too happy about these two guys. She didn't like them. She just knew the three of us had were constant trouble. And my daughter was born. They came by the house one Easter Sunday. My daughter was about 3 years old. And two weeks old. And they were going to do something on Easter Sunday. They wanted me to go with them. And I just said, you know, I just got that look on her face that if I go, don't come back, you know. And my daughter, we were going to my mother's house for Easter dinner. So they went ahead and gone. And that night, going home, Jack got killed in a car accident. He hit a tree or a telephone pole doing about 80 miles an hour. And that was really a shock to me, just really drunk. Russ, about 10 years later, drank himself to death at the age of 37. And I carry a picture on my wall of the three of us together and at Jack's wedding, because we were both his best men. And we're all in our tuxedos and just like, you know, young Turks standing there. And I look, you know, but for the grace of God, there goes I. I'm the lucky one here. You know, these guys are gone because of alcohol. And I just didn't seem to realize that. You know, I kept drinking. And finally, these kids grew up. You know, they got going out on their own and doing things. And I just kept doing my thing. And this wife and I had been divorced a couple of times and got back together again. And I mean, I had an affair, and she had an affair. Only I got real ticked about that. You know, I just thought, and I went after her boyfriend, and I tried to chase him in the house one night, and he called the cops on me, and I got away in time, and I got smart the next week, and I went back, and I hid in the bushes with my six-pack and waited for him to come home. And the car pulled up, and the guy got out, and I jumped out of the bushes, and tackled him and jumped on him, and just as I went to hit him, I looked down and said, oh, wrong guy. It was his next door neighbor. And I said, well, you're not Vaughn. And he had a peace bond put out against me and a few other things. And he was going to start carrying a gun. And so, but that just kind of shows you some of the craziness, you know, just that I just didn't have a clue. It was all about me. You know, it was always about me, my feelings and what I wanted. And my motto was always, if it feels good, do it. And I did, and it caused a lot. Hurt a lot of people, you know. And I hurt my kids. I hurt that wife. I mean, I just hurt a lot of people and other people I was involved with. As I said, those kids grew up, you know, and they got on their own. And that wife and I kind of looked at each other, and you know, we didn't really know each other. It was just us. And I thought, you know, it was just. We just didn't have anything in common. We weren't even sleeping in the same room. And I went to work at another place, and right away fell right in with the drinking crowd at this new company. And I had worked there 10 years before. And the group would go out, and Courtney, I met her there at the meeting. And then at the bar. Then I got so I started going home with her instead of going to my house. And then one day I just moved out. I ran away from home. I just went to work one morning and never came back. Took all my clothes with me, and I moved in with her. And the one little bad thing about that was that she lived with her parents. And that was a little strange. But actually, the thing was that her parents had a lake house up in Northern California, and they were gone 4 or 5 months out of the year. So I had, you know... just the two of us there for a while, and I had to go before they got home, or before they came back, and I ended up moving in with my brother. And that's kind of where my drinking picked up. I mean, I mostly all my life have been kind of a beer drinker. I mean, I always liked beer. I drink booze once in a while, but I found Jim Beam, and did I love that Jim Beam bourbon? I loved the taste of it. I loved what it did for me. It was just. I always had to have one of those sitting. I just loved the label, even just the way the label looked. It looked good, cool. And of course, incidentally, I married a woman whose father's name was Jim Beam. How ironic is that? So anyway, I moved in with this gal, and it was fantastic. I mean, she drank with me. We had a great. I mean, she never harped on me. We did it while my drinking, and it just was. It just went absolutely fantastic. For about a year. And then she started making little comments about it, you know, little things and making drugs. No, don't do that. And then it started getting more comments, and it started getting a little worse. And I had to remind her that she had a little daughter, a 5-year-old daughter. She needed to tell her what to do. Don't tell me what to do. My mother raised me. I don't need a mother. And we get into these big things about it. And God, do you have to drink when we go out? Do you have to drink? I said, I don't have to. I want to. That's all. I just want to. And we were at her house one time, and of course, I'd spent the night, woke up the next morning, and I'd actually had a bourbon of water on the table alongside me. And we were going to go someplace, and she'd gotten up to go take a shower, and I just looked up and reached over, and I grabbed that bourbon of water, and I drank it down. or again, that phenomena craving takes over. And I went out into the liquor cabinet, her dad's liquor cabinet, by the way, and poured myself a few more drinks. And by the time she came out of the shower and was cleaned up and ready to go, I was hammered. And she couldn't believe it, you know, just couldn't believe it. Oh, my God, I've been in the bathroom looking. You're drunk. You know? What the hell? And I'm fine. You know? Don't worry. And so we go out, and if we go out to dinner, you know, she's pleaded with me when I said, well, could you please just one night, could we go to dinner and you just not drink? Just could you just try it once? And I go, oh, God, just, you know, the sake of an argument, that this World War III, and all right, I'll try it. And naturally, the first time you go to dinner, and the first thing you do is you sit down, the waiter walks up, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And I said, well, of course I'd like a cocktail before dinner. And then I'd get that deer in the headlight look, you know. And I go, but I'll have an iced tea. And I have an iced tea. And we'd do a dinner and then go to an early show and get her home by 9 o'clock. And I guess how to word it. My reward was I could spend the night, you know. Privileges, I guess. That was the farthest thing from my mind. I wanted out of there. I was, by the time I get back to her house and I'm sitting on the couch, and she's laying down, got her legs in my lap. And I'm thinking, I have to get out of here because I want a drink. And I mean, I want one now. And I know if I get up and leave that this is going to be just holy war. You know, just go on and on and on. And I'm just not, I'm really not up to it. All I want to do is a drink. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, I remember in my mind, she likes to have her feet rubbed. And when she gets her feet rubbed, it makes her sleepy. And I thought, you know, I'm willing, and I'm not big on rubbing other people's feet. That's not, you know, that's not my bag. But when you're desperate, you'll go to any length. And I got that foot, and I started working on it. And I worked on it, and I was going, and I kind of look up at her, and I can see the eyes flutter a little bit. And I go, hey, man, I can go pro here, you know. And I'm really working and working it on, and the eyes are closing and closing. Finally, about 10 minutes, and she is a real sound sleeper. And so I just get up, moved her feet, put a little note there. You went to sleep on me, so I just went home, you know. And I made a beeline for Vendome Liquor, got me a fifth of Jim Beam and two cans of beer. And that two cans of beer was going to get me that four blocks home. And I'm driving home from that liquor store there and just chug-a-lugging that beer down. And then I'd get into the Jim Beam, and I'd finish that fifth off. Next morning, I'd go over to a place. We'd be together going to a place. And it's in the summer. I don't realize that alcohol comes out of your system. You know, it smells. And she could smell it. You know, are you drinking? How dare you? I might drink. Of course I'm not drinking. You know, does it look like I'm drinking? No, but you smell like it. And it just went on and on and on. And we just kept getting bad. And then we were supposed to go someplace again on a deal. And it was, I think it was a church thing. I don't even remember what it was. It was something. And it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was in my apartment. And I'd made myself a couple of drinks, three, maybe four. I don't know. I didn't count them. Everybody else counted them. I never counted them. And when she called and tell me she was going to pick their niece up to babysit, and she had what I called alcohol radar. She could tell over the phone if I was drinking. She could pick that up. And then we get into this. She said, you're drinking. And I said, I've had a drink. I've had a couple of, you know. Well, how could you do this? Blah, blah, blah. And it starts going on, you know, just going, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is important. We're going to this church function thing tonight, and you don't have none. And I just got, excuse the expression, pissed off. I just, you know, I'm just tired of hearing this stuff. I'm just saying. So I just ended that conversation with two words. One was a verb, the other was a pronoun. And hung the phone up and said, you know, that's it, I'm done. I'm just tired of this crap. If I want to drink, I am going to drink, and I'll do what I want to do about it. And that's what I did. I got into my bottle, and I drank it, and I finished it. I went over to the bar where my brother was drinking at the little place, and he said, I don't remember, but he said I was in there, and I was there for a half hour, and I drank six double bourbon waters. And then the bartender didn't want to serve me anymore because I was getting drunk. And he said, no more for me. And then I thought, you know, Jesus, you know, you just can't win here. You know, everybody's against you. So I said, you know, screw all of you, you know, and left there and went to Vendome and got another fifth of Jim Beam. Got home, and I got into that booze. And I drank it, and I drank, and I drank. And I sat, and I listened to music. I was all by myself. It was peaceful. I was having a good time. But I noticed, you know, I was getting drunk as far as walking and, you know, staggering and like that. But inside me, I was feeling everything I'd felt like I'd never even had a drink. I mean, all of a sudden, I got this big hole in my stomach. I'm making it like a just, and I got all this fear going on inside me. All this, you know, I don't, it's just like I felt like I was like on the verge of a nervous breakdown or something. And I kept drinking, I kept drinking. And I finally went in and I tried to go to bed. And I laid down on the bed and I laid and I tossed and I turned. And then all of a sudden, I just started crying. I could not stop crying. I said, I'm having a nervous breakdown. I know this is exactly what's happening. And somehow I rolled out of the bed onto my knees, and I was leaning kind of over the bed, just luckily got in that position, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. God, help me, please. And I had never been to AA before in my life, didn't know anything about AA. And my brother who was living with me, or I was living with him, had a friend at work that he worked with who had been in the program, who was in AA, and he used to come home and talk about him all the time. And this guy lived on Skid Row for 9 years, and he got sober and blah, and he just, you know, raved about him all the time. And then he'd go to meetings with him when he was speaking, and he would bring literature home with him and lay it on the table for me. I thought it was for him. I didn't pay any attention to it. It wasn't for me. But for some reason, and unbeknownst to me to this day, I don't know why I got up and walked in and grabbed a phone, called the operator, and told her I was trying to reach Alcoholics Anonymous. I was too drunk to see the phone because she'd dial it for me. And she did. And I talked to somebody and was talking to somebody at central office. And I don't remember what we were talking about. And my brother came home, which was very odd because, you know what, he stayed out late. And it was about 11 o'clock. And he came in. And I'm just, you know, in tears and I'm just shaking. And you know, wanted to find out what was wrong, and so I hung up, and he said, let me call Chuck. So he called Chuck and got him, I guess he got him out of bed, and I got on the phone with him, and I remember he talked to me, and he said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I just can't do what I'm doing anymore. I'm just, you know, I'm falling apart here at the seams. I just, my whole body's collapsing on me. And he said, well, go to bed. Everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. And call me in the morning, and we'll talk some more. And I did. I went in and I went to bed, and I went to sleep. Woke up the next morning, hungover. I mean, I was sick. I called him, and he came over and he talked to me that afternoon. He told me his story about him, and I talked to him, but I kept crying. I just kept, you know, I could not. And I don't cry, you know. I just, and I couldn't figure just what the heck was wrong with me. And he knew what was wrong with me. And he said, well, I want to take you to a meeting tonight if you want to go. And I said, sure, I will go. And still not knowing what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about, didn't know anything about it. And I drove over to his house later that night. I met his wife. And they took me to my first meeting. And I can remember, the name of the meeting was called Saturday Night Live. It was out in the San Fernando Valley. And I'm standing out there, and just like you're in suspended animation or something, you know, you're not there. It's like an out-of-body experience. And I'm just watching all these people pull up in these cars and get out and walk up. They're hugging each other, and they're shaking hands. And I'm watching them. They're going in this door, this building. And I started thinking about that movie, Close Encounters of a Third Kind. Really, when that spaceship landed, and all those people were waiting for it, and they all were going into that spaceship because something was going to happen to them, and I just kind of knew something was going to happen to me when I went in that room, and so I did. I went in there, and I don't remember much about the first meeting. After the meeting, we drove home, and I was shaking so bad, and I was so sick, that he stopped at the store, and he bought some orange juice and Carol syrup. They took me to their house. They detoxed me on that, and he started talking about the program. And he talked about sponsorship. I had no idea what a sponsor was. And I said, well, you know, So he explained to me, and I said, well, I don't know anybody. And I said, would you sponsor me? He said, well, if I do, I'm going to ask you to do some things that you may not like. He said, and I know about you. I know your history. I know your brother. And I know where you are about taking orders and about authority and everything else. And so he said, this is the only condition. You got to do what I tell you. And he said the same thing what I said earlier. You know, you give me 90 days. And in that 90 days, you want to do this, I'll gladly refund your misery. And so he started talking, told me, well, you're gonna read the bid book. You're going to call me every day at a certain time. We're going to get into these steps. You're going to get commitments at all these meetings, and these 90 meetings you go to. Well, meanwhile, so I started going to all these meetings every day, you know, for about 3 weeks. Now, this girlfriend that had all the trouble with Bill about the drinking, now that I'm going to all these meetings, she's ticked off because I'm not around that much. I'm going to these meetings all the time, you know. Can't win for losing. But I did. I started getting commitments at all these meetings, and I actually started feeling good. You know, I started coming out. And probably about the first month, that little committee started working up there. And I always said this committee they start holding board meetings, and they don't invite me. And they start making decisions about things. And the decision was, maybe you jumped the gun, Tom. Maybe you weren't quite as bad as you thought you were, you know, because I felt good. And I said, well, you know, it could be right. And I actually started thinking about, maybe I did. Maybe I should go back out there for a while and give it another try. But I talked to Chuck about it, and he explained that to me. He said, well, you're going to get a lot of that. So just, you know, just stick. Remember, you're going to give me 90 days. And after that, you do what you want. And So I did. I started doing those 90 days. And then I said, you know, things started getting better, and I started getting into this program, and I was for about 6 months. Then all of a sudden, I started goofing off again. You know, I started kind of just, as he called it, nickel and diming it. And then I'd broken up with this girlfriend, and I got into another relationship, which was going from the frying pan into the fire. And, you know, I heard this guy speak one night, and he said, you know, I could line 10 women up against the wall to pick one I want, and I'll pick the sickest one every time. And that's kind of what I would do, you know. And she was a sick one. And I lasted to that about 4 or 5 months, I guess it was. And so I wanted out, and I left, got out of it. And I was just, you know, I was getting anger. A lot of anger was coming in me, a lot of feelings, a lot of things were happening. And I was, you know, it's kind of like one of those things, you break up with somebody, but you don't want them to go without with anybody until you're ready, you know. You kind of want to control. You stick there, but I'm done with you, but you don't go out with anybody right yet. And she started going out with one of my AA brothers about 30 days later. And I got a real big resentment about that one. I mean, a real big resentment. And, you know, my sponsor told me to live with it. You know, I made a choice. And I go to a meeting one night, and they came in, and he walks up to me and stuck his hand out, and I kind of blew up. You know, I just told him, get away from me, and get away from me right now, because, you know, I'm about to kick your ass. You know, I mean, I was so pissed, you know. And then I go over to my sponsor, and I'm telling him, and he's kind of getting in my face about it, and I thought, you know, screw all of you. You know, screw all of you. And I just walked out of the meeting. I fired him and left. And he said, you know, he's telling me, well, he won't last out there very long now. And I didn't. You know, I was just living on the edge, living on the brink. Ended up back with the first girlfriend again, which was a real big mistake. And we had gone up to that. But this time I'm close to 2 years sober. And, you know, I just don't have any program. I don't really have any program at all. And I'm a real dry drunk. And miserable, I'm agitated, I'm, you know, quick-tempered, I get pissed real easy at people. I used to have a lot of, well, I still do once in a while, that problem with people on the road, I have little things. One of my big things is I have problems with people that don't use blinkers. And, you know, you're waiting to go out an alley or a driveway and they're coming at you and they don't use a blinker, then they'll turn. And I want to follow them and stop them and go in their car and reach my hand in her and rip it off the side of their arm and say, you don't really need this. You don't use it, so I'm going to collect them, you know, and I just want to see how many I can put in my trunk. And it's kind of like Ben spoke at our meeting about 2 months ago, and he was talking about spirituality and all that, you know, just really getting into it. And he gave a great talk. And Sandy and I are walking down El Paseo one morning, and we take a walk every morning, and I'm walking across the street there by California Pizza Kitchen, and this guy's parked. He comes in and he stops, and he's right in the crosswalk. So I have to walk around him. And right away that stood the hair up, and I just kind of looked at him, and I said, "You're in the crosswalk, asshole." And Sandy walked by, and she says, "You didn't listen to Ben very good last night, did you?" And it just, you know, it just does it. It just happens. And you know, sometimes I bite off more than I can chew, and I've done it before. And I used to say when I drank out in those bars, sometimes it became a contact sport, because sometimes, you know, they say shut up. I thought they said stand up, you know, and then and then it started. And a couple of broken noses, and I got beat up real bad one night, ended up in the hospital. And I think I got that butt whipped for just puking. I don't think the guy liked somebody puking. I never did find out why. And so anyways, I'm close to tears, and this girl and I go back up to the lake again, and we're just fighting, just constantly fighting. And I just want to leave. I just want to get in my car and go back. But I promised her daughter. She had a little daughter. It was a good little kid, but we were going to take her to San Francisco. And so I thought I'd stick around for that, and I did. We got back. And I got some postcards, and I mailed them out to my kids. I was going to mail them to my kids and wrote them all out. And I just told her, I said, you know, I just need to take a ride. I'm going to go into the little lake town there. And I drove into it, and I was going to the post office and drop my these cards off. As I'm pulling into the post office, there's a bar across the street, and these guys are all standing outside, and they've got these long necks. Understand her? And why I thought about that, I have no idea. It just hit my head. I said, I don't think I've ever had a long neck. You know, just that quick it hit me. And all of a sudden, they decided, that's what I'm going to do. You know, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to get just hammered, and I'm going to go back to her place and tell her, look what you've done to me. This is all your fault and the whole thing, you know. Just really in a pity pot, feeling sorry for myself. And so I go to the post office. I drop the cards in the mailbox, and I'm walking across the park. And I mean, I can almost taste that drink. I mean, really, I had no inhibitions about it. I didn't have any fear. I didn't have any remorse. I mean, I was heading for that bar. And just as I was walking across, this pickup truck backs right out. And I walked into the side of it, and I hit it. And went, hey! So the guy stopped, and as I walk around the back of the truck, so help me God, the guy's got bumper stickers all over it. One day at a time, easy does it. Let go, let God. And I walked around the front of the truck, and he was sitting in this old guy. I can still see his face today. Got these big bib overalls on, and a straw hat, and a red handkerchief around his neck. So I looked at him and I said, "You friend of Bill W's?" And he said, "Yep." And I said, "Well, I'm almost 2 years sober." And I said, "I'm having a real bad day, and I'm ready to walk across to that bar and have a drink." And the guy, again, hear his words exactly. He looked at me and he said, "Well, you better get your ass to a meeting, boy." And I said, "Well, I don't live up here. I don't need, you know, I don't know it." He said, "You hold your horses. I'm going to show you where there's one." So he pulls back in the spot. Gives me a little map. There's an all-day. They go all the time. And he said, "Now you get your butt over there and get it over there quick." And he said, "I see your butt over in that bar. You and I are going to have some trouble." And he was like 60, 70 years old. And I said, "By God, you know, he probably could get some trouble." And so I went to that meeting. I got over and I jumped in my car and I went to that meeting. And I shared and I got it out and I talked and people talked to me. And then that, you know, that whole thing left me, and I got back and told her we're leaving the next morning. I took her home, and after I deposited her suitcases on the front lawn, I said goodbye and got off and drove off down the street saying, "Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." And you know, and I'm thinking, if I would have been 10 seconds later or 10 seconds sooner, I would have missed that truck, you know. I would have, and that's why I said in the beginning, it's like a divine intervention that stepped in there. And, you know, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And, you know, I tried to drink. You know, I tried to drink a couple other times, and he just wouldn't let me. I had a problem with the IRS. They finally caught up to me because I forgot to pay him a few years. And they have no sense of humor about that either. And they also don't like smart asses like me in there telling them that, you know, that they, you know, kind of taking their inventory and kind of like telling the guy, you know, where do they get people like you? You can't even make it as a CPA and you end up here, you know. And you don't talk to the IRS that way because they just grabbed everything. They attached everything I had. And I had been in a meeting about a month before that, and there was a guy there, a speaker, Jim M. I think a lot of you know him. He was in a wheelchair, and he spoke. And he was from Iowa, and I was from Iowa. And he gave me his card, and he said, you know, he said, give me a call sometime. He was a judge at the time. And he said, I'm only home on Tuesdays. Every other day I'm in court. And so I said, great. So we'll chat sometime. And I put the card down, and this is like a month later when this all happened. And I'd forgot about him at first. And after the IRS attached my wages, my bank account, and everything, I again said, screw it. You know, I'll live in my car. I'm going to quit my job, and they can shove it, you know. And I was living with a friend of mine at the time, and he had a liquor cabinet, and I poured a drink. I was ready to drink again. And all of a sudden, I remembered Jim. And this, again, was Tuesday morning, the only morning he would be home out of court. And I called and got a hold of him, told him who I was, and I said what I was going to do. And he said, well, pour the drink out, pour it out. And he gave me the name of a tax attorney. And he said, you call this guy and you tell him that I sent you there. I want you to talk to him and let him handle it. Don't you talk to the IRS. He just, yeah, leave them alone. You let him do everything. And he did. The tax attorney set it up, and I set up a payment thing. And it took me 6 years to pay those guys off. But I did. I paid every penny of it back. And it was about 20-some grand, you know. And and you don't even miss one payment because they get you a nasty little letter. And so I'm not a real big fan of the IRS today. But that was, you know, just some of the things I get, you know, that what I call a divine intervention. I just was not meant to drink again. You know, something always got in my way, and I think God was looking over me, watching me, and said, and I never was, you know, I mean, I believed in something, but I never was a big, you know. And I just, he just figured, you know, I got to keep an eye on this guy. He's just too damn stupid to do it down there by himself. And I think I was. And, but I paid, like I said, I paid them off. And then I got into this program. You know, I really decided this is what I needed to do. And I became secretary of a meeting, and I started sponsoring guys, and I started, you know, I started going to a lot of meetings. And I got a new sponsor. And things started getting better in my life. I just started feeling better, you know, and that was the main thing, you know. You just want to start feeling. You want to get that fear out of your body and that tenseness and that just, you know, that just like someone's peeking over your shoulder all the time. And that you know, why me? Why me? You know, and I just, you know, you kind of start feeling sorry for yourself. And it's like the old saying, pour me a drink. And that's just kind of the way it was. I mean, I just came so close so many times to do it. And after about 2 years, I finally, you know, it started sinking in. This is what I need to do to stay sober. And so I stayed, you know, started going to meetings, started doing all the stuff I had to do. And the company I was with at the time, I had a great job, was working well, and I was doing a lot of traveling. Wasn't drinking again. That was a tough one because I used to travel a lot and used to drink a lot. And I'd moved to Phoenix. And just before I moved to Phoenix, I found out that, and I had made the peace with this former first sponsor of mine. And then I found out that just before I left, that he started drinking again after 12 years of sobriety. And within a year, he was dead. He drank himself to death. And I used to come through town. I would drove from Phoenix because I was on the road a lot, and I'd drive through, and I'd stop. I stopped at a Saturday night meeting there that he and his wife and a few other people started, Sandy, had started. And I'll get to that later. And I asked her one night, I said, you know, I hadn't seen her one. I said, I'm living in Phoenix now, and I said, I know he's doing real bad. I said, gave her my card, and I said, you know, if something happens or, you know, whatever, would you just give me a call? And that was a Saturday night. And I was going home back to Phoenix Monday morning. Thursday morning, she called me. And right away, when she said, this is Sandy Andreessen, I knew what it was. And Chuck had died. They found him dead in an apartment someplace. He drank himself. So I went in for his funeral. And even though he and I had, you know, our problems and things, and it wasn't really him against me. It was me because I just had the problems, you know. He gave me a hell of a foundation. He really did. I think he really taught me the program. And I felt really, you know, grateful to him. And so I came in for his memorial and went back to Phoenix. That was in September of 93, I think it was, yeah. And January 94, they had the big earthquake in Northridge. And Sandy lived right on top of the epicenter. And it just, you know, did a lot of damage to her house. And so I called her, see how she, her, and the kids were doing. And we talked on the phone and got to talking. And we ended up having a really nice long conversation. And it was always kind of funny because in the beginning, we didn't really like each other. She kind of got in my face one night at a meeting because my sponsor had spoken someplace and I didn't go to the meeting, and she told me about it, and I got a big resentment about that. You know, and I thought, you know, God, what a bitch, you know. What the hell she thinks she is? She's not my sponsor. And I made a big deal out of it. And she told me I was an arrogant, you know, so-and-so. And I was. I was a lot of arrogance, you know. I come in with a, you know, some people come with a chip. I had a 2x4 on my shoulder, really, you know, just arrogance. I just didn't, you know, if I didn't like talking, I'd get smart-ass, you know, I could snap back, or, you know, I just the way I was. Well, we had this conversation on the phone, and I thought, you know, not that, she's kind of nice. So I got through, when I'd come through town, I would stop and visit her. And the following August, I think I came in there and we're talking, and we had some really nice conversation. I said, God, how would you like to go out some night and have some dinner or show or something? And she liked that, so we did. We've been together ever since. It was kind of, when I tell people I married my sponsor's wife, they kind of look at me kind of funny. But he'd been dead a year, so. But we have a great life together. You know, we have a great life. We've been able to do a lot of things. And again, like I said, everything I have in this is, you know, today, and it's a lot of great. I have been able to do things I never thought I'd be able to do. We were able to make a trip across the United States about 4 or 5 years ago. And I always wanted to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame because I'm a baseball nut. And so she said, well, you know, we just don't want to drive right to the Baseball Hall of Fame. We probably should stop here. So she made a little plan out, and we went to Santa Fe, and we went to Graceland, and got up to the Football Hall of Fame, and went down to Akron, went to Dr. Bob's house, and sat in the kitchen. We sat there and had coffee at the table, and Dr. Bob and I called Luther, my sponsor, and I said, Luther, you'll never guess where I am. Sandy and I were sitting in Dr. Bob's kitchen having a cup of coffee. And what a spiritual thing that was. When we walked in the door, the first thing the guy says is, welcome home. And took us, you know, on the tour of the place, and saw Bill's room where he slept when he stayed there, in Smitty's room, and he showed us the bathroom upstairs. They had the laundry chute. He told how Bob used to drop his bottles, get up there and drink, and drop his bottles down the chute, then get up in the middle of the night, take them across the street, and put them in the trash can of his neighbor. And the neighbor kept saying, I wonder who's doing that. He said, I know it's not that nice doctor across the street. And we got to the Baseball Hall of Fame and Bar Harbor, and went to Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and Gettysburg. And and all this would not have been possible if I'd have been doing, you know, my old ways. If I'd have been drinking still, or I probably wouldn't be here if I was still. I'd be ending up like Russ and Jack. And I did have a doctor tell me before I quit drinking that, you know, and I ended up in a coronary unit for a week. And I had like an angina, I guess, or something. And I got pulled out of work in an ambulance and rushed to spend, you know, time up there. And the doctor knew that my liver was starting to swell, and my eyes were turning yellow, and he knew that, you know, right away he figured it out. And kept telling me that I needed to stop drinking. And I didn't do it. And about the third time I went back, and he finally said, "Don't come back here anymore. I don't want to see you. You're wasting my time. You're wasting other patients. You want to die? Go out there and die. I don't care. It don't mean nothing to me." And so that's just what I needed to do. And I could have died if I'd have just kept going another year or two. You know, if I would have, that Jim Beam would have got to me. I love this program. You know, I really do. I've been around here for a while now. I meant to say at the beginning, my sobriety date is May 11th, 1984. I have a home group, which is the Wednesday night Black Sheep meeting. I have a sponsor, Luther, a loving sponsor. And I'm going to be 30 next May, and my 30th birthday. And I've asked Luther, I told him what I'd like to do, to go through the steps again. And we're going to start doing that. And I said, on my 30th birthday, I would really like to go, you know, and do the whole thing again. And, you know, I did it once, but that was a long time ago. And I think I really need to go through it again. And, you know, just there's so much love in this. There's so many friends, you know, somebody just that we moved out here 5 years ago or 8 years ago. And, you know, with Mike and Barb and Henry and Melanie and Harry. And thank God Harry was going to come and heckle me tonight, and he didn't. So I appreciate that, Harry. He was going to hold cards up, you know, and give me, like they do in the Olympics, 4, 5, or whatever. And thank you for not doing that. And Dave told me not to worry about anybody here because you'd all be thinking about yourselves, not me. So. And but it's been a great deal. And I love my life today. It's been great, and I know it could even get better. So, and. My wife got me nice and dressed tonight with Brent's haircut. I look pretty good, so thank you.